Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. One of the great things about this state is that 244 years after we adopted the Vermont Constitution and 230 years after we became a state, we still have a citizen legislature. Let that sink in for a moment. In just 5 months each year, the women and men of our House and Senate set aside their jobs, get the work done of proposing, debating, and passing laws. They create a budget to keep the state operating and to care for the most vulnerable citizens. And whether you agree with everything they vote in favor of or vote down, they serve this state with the best intentions. This hour, we'll get to hear from two of our state representatives, Teresa Wood and Tom Stevens, from the Washington-Chittenden district that is comprised of Waterbury, Bolton, Huntington, and Buell's Gore. And you'll have the opportunity to speak with them as well in that fine Vermont tradition. Representative Wood, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Rick.
It's great to have you. And Representative Stevens, thanks for being on the program as well today.
Yeah, thank you, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question for our representatives, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Teresa Wood, in year two of virtual legislating, how did you find being able to work with your committee and the legislature overall?
Well, it's been an interesting experience, Rick, one for the record books for sure. In this year, I have a new role. I'm vice chair of the House Human Services Committee now. And so as a member of leadership, trying to make sure that you are being inclusive of all of your committee members, especially new committee members who have just joined the legislature and this is their first assignment, and making sure that communication as you're intending it is really coming across to the people who are receiving it is was a big challenge. And also trying to remember that we have people watching us on YouTube. And so you kind of get lost in the Zoom world and recognizing then later something you may have said may have been misinterpreted or whatever when you hear comments back from people watching on YouTube. But all in all, I feel like it was a very successful session, and I feel like we maintained and perhaps even in some circumstances increased the public access to what we do in Montpelier.
That is a good thing. Tom Stevens, were there positives you see developing from how you've been forced to operate these past two sessions?
The access that Teresa was just talking about is probably one of the most positive things when it comes to the process of what we were doing. And in order to get witnesses to testify via Zoom, it was so much more convenient for them to have their voices heard over Zoom rather than, say, if you lived in Bennington, to come up to Montpelier for the day in order to testify or to testify by phone while everyone else is in the room. It was more effective, I think, for folks and their voices to get, to be heard by us because you didn't have to drive 3 or 4 hours each way if the weather was bad. And with that came, I think, more education for folks about what we were working with, because this was really one for the record books. I mean, we were working on stuff that we've never worked on before, but we were working through a pandemic and what that represented, which was not only relief for people who needed help, but how do you do a regular budget as if there was no pandemic? And then how do you deal with the extra tax money, the one-time tax money that came in? And so dealing with it, dealing with those issues, and I'm glad that we have those resources to work with, but really, I think accessibility was probably the most positive thing. I think, personally and physically, it was really difficult on the legislators and the folks who were trying to get this work done. But for the folks within who got a chance to work with us to fashion these bills and to try to find the relief that they needed. This certainly was quite a different way of doing it, and I suspect that we'll try to incorporate some of the positive things that we learned from this kind of technology when we go back in person.
Mm-hmm. Teresa Wood, did I detect a note though of longing for the days of being able to work together at the State House?
Well, of course. I think I think every single legislator and all of those folks that we encounter each day during a normal legislative session would all say that same thing. There's a sense of building a team. There's a sense of being able to quickly get an answer to a question, to lobby for your position, frankly, to be able to catch legislators in the hallway, to have our, what we call our cafeteria meetings where, you're on a sticky subject and you say, okay, folks, go up to the cafeteria and hash this out. All of that kind of stuff really is not present when you're doing stuff on Zoom.
Yeah.
So, of course, we are looking forward to a return to the State House, although it will be different than the past, but we will be returning.
Tom Stevens, heading into this session, what were you hoping would be addressed by the legislature, and how pleased are you with the outcomes?
Well, that's not a broad question. I think that I was hoping that we would... The difference between this session and last session was last session we were reacting to the pandemic, and we were reacting to what the federal government was able to get us, and also to work through our budget. And we worked through the end of September with a couple of, months off in the summertime. But it was reactive. And coming into this one, I think I was afraid of what was it going to be like when we had to be proactive, when we had to actually deal with this process, the Zoom world, in real time. And our leadership and the Senate leadership and the governor's office really treated this session as if there wasn't a pandemic when it comes to the calendar. They really wanted to adhere to the calendar of how we usually do business, which meant adjourning in mid-May. Mm-hmm. So taking that into account, the individual processes the individual bills that we may have been looking to do. I mean, I was focused on housing mostly. We saw that as a rule, there's 2,500 Vermonters, almost 400 of which are children, are homeless on any given night. Mm-hmm. And we saw that throughout the pandemic, and we housed them in motels. But we had to develop a policy that had to kind of wean us off this system as the state came back to normal, and those hotel rooms became necessary for those hotels to house tourists, for instance. But developing the housing and finding out what we could do with the housing money that was coming to us from Washington was a huge priority, and we've managed to set up programs that are going to provide through the end of this year, perhaps through the middle of next year, upwards of $100 million in rent for people who need it, for people who are at 80% of the area median income or below. And that's not just for tenants. That's money that would go to the property owners and the landlords in order to make sure that their business stays afloat too, but also to keep people in housing. We know that we wanted to keep some of the protocols that we adopted last year, which is to keep people safe during a public safety problem. And we've done that for the most part. There's some difficult conversations that still have to be had about housing folks and making sure that people aren't on the street by the time the fall and the winter comes back around. And, we have a lot of money to invest that came from the federal government. We are hoping that we can get a lot more units online spread out across the state where people are. So that was that part, the housing portion of it was a big piece for me. And then the second big piece for me was a resolution that we passed, that both House and Senate passed, that we called JRH2, which was a public apology for our policies and practices that accentuated eugenics movement in the early part of the 20th century, which was a real black mark in Vermont history. And here in Waterbury, it was played out quite a bit at the state hospital, where we took advantage of people who were experiencing poverty, poor people, people of color, people of our indigenous population, our disabled population. We instituted policies that were downright cruel and inhuman. And it was time for us to issue a statement through the General Assembly. This hasn't been a statewide apology yet, but the General Assembly's role in establishing these policies and promulgating them. And it was a really moving time to work on that and to hear the stories of what we did 100 years ago or more and how it affects people still today.
Teresa Wood, was there a specific priority of yours, and how did it fare in this session?
Well, probably one of the most pressing things that we've heard about during this pandemic is child care. Mm-hmm. And how child care, I think in certain pockets, we certainly knew that child care was essential. However, the pandemic really shined a light on that for the public as a whole and for people to understand that child care is essential for Vermont families. It's essential for the health of children. It's essential for our economy and for our businesses to work. It's essential for our health care. Healthcare workers need child care. And yet, we really have not supported child care in a way that makes it fully accessible for everyone, that pays fair wages to those working in the child care field, and that is available in all parts of the state, particularly for infants and very young children. And so, yes, I am happy to say that we made great strides in child care this session, building upon the work that we did a couple of years ago. We passed H 171 that really not only puts forth investments in the child care workforce, but it expands eligibility for the Child Care Financial Assistance Program to more middle-income Vermonters. And those individuals who are on REACH-UP, which is a state assistance program for very low-income individuals, those individuals will no longer have to pay a copay. So it is a big investment. We are also setting the stage for what future investments might be. This is just part of a plan. We will be revisiting this over the next 2 to 3 years to ensure that we are making the investments that are really going to impact families. And when it comes to federal money, we have over $47 million in new COVID relief that we want to make sure is invested that will help set us up for the future. Even though these particular things are some one-time investments, we want to make sure that it lays the foundation for things that we will be able to do as a state, as employers, as the federal government, as in partnership to really make sure that child care is accessible and affordable to all.
Representative Stevens, the one thing that got some traction early on and then was moved to a summer study is the idea of how to clear up our unfunded pensions. How much longer can the state afford to go without a clear plan to get the unfunded pensions cleared up?
I think the outside right now is if we do nothing and the folks of retirement age now, so we're basically talking about baby boomers and above who retire now, the system may just be structurally unsound after another 10 or 15 years. There's such a big, huge population jump in that time frame, and so if everybody retires at once, and there's not enough people or not the same amount of people paying into the pension system presently, then that money would go fairly quickly. And then, of course, the more you pay out, the less that you have to invest, and the investment returns become lesser over time. Mm-hmm. And there's some questions about and some differences of opinion about the gravity of that, but our legislative fiscal, joint fiscal office was pretty clear that without, and the treasurer was very clear that without some changes to the system, that it would go bankrupt, you know, within the next generation, and that would be awful. We don't really have an interest in seeing our state workers or our teachers lose their pensions, and that would just be a terrible downslope of events, of outcomes. We wouldn't be able to attract teachers. We wouldn't be able to attract people to work for the state. But again, this task force will get put together this summer and start to put together a plan where everybody sits at the table first to agree on what the problem is and then to start proposing solutions for it. We hope that by January we'll have a much better idea of what we need to do and need in order to move forward. But I think it's tantamount to paramount to all of us that we protect this pension system.
Representative Wood, do you have ideas on what needs to be done to correct this problem?
Well, I think, Rick, that there is no one single solution. And I think that's the key thing that listeners need to understand. So, and as well as teachers, state employees, the people, the taxpayers who are the ones contributing to this, as well as the employees. And I think that we need to look at, are we making the right investment decisions? You know, that's one of the key things that is being looked at in terms of making changes to the structure of the groups that make those decisions. I think that is important. I think another thing that's important to understand is there are three pension funds that are managed by the state and the treasurer's office, and the third one is the municipal employees. The municipal employees fund is in good stead. Their ratio is upwards of over 80%, whereas both the state employees and teachers are at 50% or less. And I think that a key difference there is municipal employees contribute more. They contribute almost twice as much in terms of their participation than state employees and teachers. And so I think it's going to have to be a combination of looking at what we can expect from employees to contribute towards this pension and what we can expect from taxpayers to contribute towards this pension issue, and agreeing that this is not going to stay stagnant. You know, I think that's sort of a unfortunate communication and setup issue that happened the last time there were changes made to this several years ago. You know, people thought they were given the impression that, okay, we're fixing this problem forever. Well, the reality is that things change. Investments change. The number of people employed change. All of those things have implications for the health of the fund. So whatever we agree to in the end next year is going to have provisions that allow for some review and changes as things progress.
Tom Stevens.
And Rick,
go ahead.
Yeah, Rick, just on this pension, the last thing, you know, is I think what folks should understand is that 5 years ago, our pension, our share of it, that's the government or all taxpayers' share of it, was probably around $60 million. And just due to circumstances, and as Teresa mentioned, the many different gears that are shifting here, this year alone, we're putting in $300 million. Mm-hmm. And the legislature put aside another $150 million in order to deal with our share of our pensions. And this was totally unexpected. This increase was totally unexpected. But when you think about $300 million coming out of the general fund, think about what it doesn't buy. You know, in terms of affordable housing, you know, we could build, you know, 2,000 units with that money, but that's never been available for housing. But in order to fulfill our commitments, that's what it costs this year. That's why it's that's why it's so important to get to the table and try to figure it out, is that this is coming out of the general fund, and this is the commitment. It's not a question of choosing which commitment to pay for, because we've made the commitment to the employees and we should uphold that. Mm-hmm. But it is making a dent in what else we may be able to do. And of all the money that's become available to us from the federal government, it's explicitly stated that none of it can be used to help your public pension funds. So we have to find this money on our own.
And am I safe to say that 2022, this coming session, we've got to have an agreement, we've got to have a plan that passes through the legislature in 2022?
Yes. You would be correct. I mean, I think in our eyes, the sooner, and then in the eyes of the employees. I mean, there's so many employees who have put in their 30 years who are reaching a retirement age, whether that's in their early 50s or in their mid 60s, who some people want to continue working. And, but if they find that their pension program is going to change not in their favor, if they stay working longer, they're going to retire when they're able to take full advantage of their pension, of the pension that they earned. And if that happens, that's a serious brain drain in our state government. And so, yeah, I would advocate as soon as possible. I would agree with you.
All right. We're close to a break, so it's best not to launch another question right now. Listeners, I do have representatives Teresa Wood, Tom Stevens from the Washington Chittenden District, takes in Waterbury, Huntington, Bolton, and, of course, Buell's Gore. Can't forget Buell's Gore. If you'd like to join the conversation, our numbers are 244-1777. Toll-free, it's 877-291-8255 if you're calling from outside the Waterbury area. And even if you're outside of the representative's district, feel free. You can call in and ask them a question or make suggestions about legislation you'd like to see. Again, toll-free, 877-291-8255 and also 244-1777. And you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Representative Wood, the governor vetoed municipal voting bills for non-U.S. citizens. What are your thoughts on the bill and whether the veto should be overridden?
Well, I think it's an interesting topic. It comes down to some thoughts about a variety of areas, but one is around local municipalities' ability to control what they do in local government. And I happen to have some affinity with the governor's thoughts about, you know, should we do this on a town-by-town basis, a city-by-city basis, or should we look at this from a statewide perspective? That being said, I think that we do have to have some respect for what local citizens overwhelmingly approved in their local communities. And looking at folks who pay taxes and contribute to the economic base of their local communities, but then not having a say in how those tax dollars are spent, I think is an important point. So I think that there are multiple ways to take a look at this, but I am hopeful that the local communities will be able to have their voices heard.
Tom Stevens, do you think allowing non-U.S. citizens the right to vote on municipal issues should be allowed when it is passed by a city or town?
Absolutely. I mean, when local municipalities pass these local ordinances, if you will, or changes to their charter, and they come up to the government, when it's such a substantial vote in favor of doing that from those municipalities, I think it's the responsibility of the legislature to do what they do, you know, which is to listen and to hear. But in a case like this, I think that it was we made the right choice of approving those charter changes, and I hope that we can get the votes to override. I see it as being a harder thing to do on a statewide basis, but I think when local municipalities such as Winooski and Montpelier, which are pretty diverse communities, choose to do this, I think we should listen to them and allow them to do it on their local level. It doesn't change the voting on statewide offices. This is all for specifically local issues. But if you're a taxpayer in those communities, you should have an opportunity to have a voice.
Let's go to the phones.
The other thing I'll add to that is that it also, by approving it on a small scale that's already been approved by local voters, it gives us an opportunity to see how that works,
right.
You know, to see how this can impact participation in local government, and then perhaps look at that at a statewide level. So it's not really different from looking at sort of an incubator of looking at how we might improve our access to voting.
That's an excellent point. Let's go to the phones. We're going to take a call from Bill, who's joining us from Middlebury. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. Thank you for the time.
Mm-hmm.
I have tried to simplify a complicated subject, but education taxes in Vermont obviously are a concern with most property owners in the state. And over the last year, we've seen property values skyrocket, to put it mildly, in some cases 30% in the last year. This is going to impact the common level of assessment for many towns significantly, which is going to impact the education tax rates by, in some cases, upwards of 10 to 15% increases over the course of the next year or two. I was wondering if either one of your legislatures is aware of the issue.
Thanks for that call. Representative Wood, I'll let you take that first.
Sure. The caller is absolutely right in terms of the impact of the skyrocketing property values, and I think that there's speculation about the overvaluing of property, during this pandemic, and I think an issue that I am actually more concerned about is the deflation of property values after some period of time when the COVID impact has retreated somewhat into history.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we saw that happen during the housing crisis back in 2008. And I think that it is, I think that the deflation factor is actually going to have more of an impact on the school tax rate. So when property values increase at such a high rate, the tax rate actually will come down. That will be insufficient when the property values then deflate. So I think that the bigger issue is how much Vermont relies on the property tax to fund education. And that is something that has troubled me, frankly, for a long time. And we don't seem to be able to reach agreement in the legislature or with the governor's office about how we should change that funding system. We have made tweaks to it over the years, and the sales tax is now being used as part of the education funding formula, and I think that has stabilized it somewhat, but it is an ongoing issue. It's an issue that we hear from our constituents on a annual basis.
Tom Stevens, what are your thoughts?
If I could follow that up quickly. Mm-hmm. So with the way the equalization study is currently done with the common level of assessments, it's based on a 3-year sales study. So while I anticipate that there probably will be a decrease in market values, I've never honestly seen anything like this in the market in the 35 years I've been working with real estate. But with an equalization study that's based upon 3 years of sales, what are you going to tell property owners when they see their common level assessment decrease by potentially double-digit numbers, which will therefore impact the education rates by a increase of 10% or more in the short term while the state's equalization study is trying to catch up.
All right, Bill, what Representative Stevens take a shot at this?
Yeah, this is there's no good answer for that, Bill. I mean, it's a great question, and I think that's what our job is going to be over the next several years, is monitoring it. I mean, we came into 2021 thinking that there was going to be a 9% increase in property taxes on the statewide level. And as it turns out, based on the extra tax money that came in with the influx of money from the federal funding last year, the property taxes on the statewide level did not go up at all. That doesn't account for the fact that on the local level they may be going up, depending on what each local municipality votes for their school budget. But I think that our job is going to be tracking what the three-year rolling average is going to be. Again, back in 2010, by the time the three-year rolling average shifted downwards to reflect the decrease in property worth at that time. And then here in Waterbury, we had in Waterbury Village, we had our house values go down after Tropical Storm Irene. And, it affected us. But I think overall, if the town is doing its reassessment, the towns generally try to balance it out so they're not actually asking for more money. They just change the tax rate. But I think this is, given the pandemic, given the change, given how federal money is going to come in for the next couple of years and how it's used, will provide a bumper of sorts. But I think for everybody who's involved and concerned about property taxes and how they're going to move forward and how we pay for education moving forward, I think we're going to be, the education and the tax committees in the state, at least in the House, are going to be focused on this very tightly because, number one, they always are. And two, again, we've not seen this kind of chaos with prices going up. I can't imagine that they'll go down as far as they've gone up, but I could have never told you a year ago heading into a pandemic that housing prices would go up 20-30% in a year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good question, Bill. That's going to be our job. It's going to be one of our jobs over the next couple of years is to focus on that.
Let's talk budget now. Representative Wood, how do you feel about how the American Rescue Plan funds were allotted?
Thanks, Rick. I think that when we look at the amount of resources that are coming into, unprecedented amounts of resources coming into the state, that we had a significant responsibility to invest those dollars in things that are going to have long-reaching impact for the residents of our state that will help them recover and to prosper after this pandemic is behind us. And I feel like we have made substantial progress in that area, and I think we came to a meeting of the minds with the governor. We differed at the outset about how to do this, and I think, really one of the things that we felt as a legislature was that we needed some focus on the people of the state of Vermont, and looking at infrastructure is absolutely important. And we did part of that with our broadband investments and with housing, but we also needed to look at the people of the state. So the investments in childcare that we're making, for instance, really impact Vermont's families and as well as businesses. So I feel good about what we did. We will have the opportunity to learn about whether we are making those investments in the right place or whether we need tweaking. We have roughly half of them left to go that we will be looking at in the next session. And I think that we reached a good compromise with the governor's office on this, and working together with the Senate and the House came to a good conclusion on that. And I think it's also important to recognize the federal partnership that we have. And as we look to infrastructure, I believe that there will be a federal infrastructure bill. I don't know exactly what it will entail, how much it will be, but it seemed to make sense to me to take what we can with the flexibility that we have, particularly with the ARPA money, to be able to invest those things that will directly impact Vermont's families, and to hold off a bit on some of the infrastructure for that major infrastructure investment coming later, hopefully this year.
We got this email from Jim, who says, 2 months ago I was listening to an education finance Zoom meeting. One of the committee members directed Dan French not to let an emergency go to waste and to grab as much federal money as he can. Is this how Vermont intends to finance budgets in the future? Tom Stevens, I know, you know, budgeting the last couple of years because of a pandemic, because of a massive influx of federal funds, certainly turns things a little bit askew. But, you know, as we next year go to create the budget for FY 2023 and those federal monies go away, you know, how do we get back to living within our means here in Vermont?
Well, we're, again, that's something that's going to have to sugar off when we see how the economy has recovered, the underlying economy, because all of this money, much of this money is going towards, you know, relief programs or programs that we couldn't otherwise afford or that are infrastructure programs. So it's, for instance, our appropriations committee basically did three budgets this year. They had to figure out how to spend our general fund money, which is our so-called normal budget, which your emailer is probably most concerned with. And so they're keeping tabs on how we're spending our tax dollars on the programs that are important to us. A lot of this other money is what they consider one-time money. And in years past, you know, over the last couple of decades, not for the last 10 or 12 years, not since the recession really, but there have been times where our budget process has included a lot of one-time money to fund ongoing programs. You have money that comes up at, you know, for instance, when we all of a sudden found out in January that there was an extra $100+ million in general fund receipts, in tax receipts. You know, where did we go? How are we going to spend that? And it's like, well, the Appropriations Committee is very careful about where they put this one-time money. And so, you know, yes, it's easy to say it's good to, you know, use a pandemic or, you know, an emergency in order to gain funds. But the funds that we're getting to help our educational system, in our higher education, which had some serious funding issues over the last couple of years, you know, we're able to use these ARPA funds in a fairly flexible way. They are going to be able to be used over the next 2 or 3 years, up until 2025, actually. The deadline of spending that money, and those of us, I think the Appropriations Committee is going to go on a roadshow this year, this summer and fall, to talk to Vermonters and say, look, there's $600 million that we haven't spent yet. You know, how should we spend it? We've made serious investments in clean water and broadband and in keeping businesses, small businesses afloat, so, and then workforce development and housing initiatives and climate change. So we're making these things, we're making these investments using this federal money in ways that are proper, but we haven't lost sight of the fact that when this money runs out in 2 or 3 or 4 years, that, whatever the new normal is, we will have to adhere to it, and you know, we will have to wean ourselves. We did this after the recession. We got a big chunk of money that we were allowed 2.5 years to spend back in 2010 and 11 and 12, and you know, finally at that point we had to budget without that money, and it wasn't easy, but we knew it was coming, and I think that'll be the same case here.
Tom Stevens mentions broadband. You know, we do have these kind of perennial situations, problems, pensions, childcare, clean water, and broadband. Representative Wood is definitely one of them. One that, you know, our lack thereof really was kind of exposed during this pandemic. So are we allocating enough now to assure that high-speed broadband will stretch completely across the state?
Well, that's the golden question, Rick. I think that one of the things that we've done is to make a change in how we approach the issue of accessibility to broadband. And you highlighted that this is something that COVID really exposed. Frankly, we've known about it for a long time, but have not had sufficient resources to be able to address it in a way that we are doing now. I mean, we've had governor after governor promise to, you know, go the last mile. And it's not for making attempts at doing that, but the resources required to do that in such a rural part of the state is quite enormous. And the thing that I think is different here is we're now relying on local communication union districts to really come together, and local communities are really pulling this together, and we are looking at the local solutions. And I think that is different than just relying on, you know, big telecommunications companies to make up their mind whether or not they're going to, you know, go to the far reaches of the Northeast Kingdom, or even places here in Waterbury lack good internet access. Mm-hmm. And so I think that relying on local communities to come up with a solution that is going to be right for them, and having the ability to put the money, the kind of money that we are infusing into that this year, we're going to see some massive improvements, I think. And the ability to spread this money out over the next, 3 to 4 years is a bonus. We did make some progress in the first round last year when we were essentially doing our COVID session. We made some progress on that, but the money, you know, at that time the rules were you had to spend it by the end of this past year. And, these projects take time to actually maneuver and get into place and get people on agreement. And while we made some strides, they were more limited than we had hoped they would be because of the limitation at the time that we allocated the money of it having to be spent by last December. So I think that we will make great strides. Whether we will hit every single community and every single person in the state is left to be seen, but we will make more strides with this money than we have made in the last 20 years.
Teresa Wood and Tom Stevens are the state representatives of the Washington-Chittenden District. That's made up of Waterbury, Bolton, Huntington, Buell's Gore. Hey, thank you both for spending an hour with us this morning.
Thanks for having us.
It's been our pleasure, Rick, and thanks so much for having us.
All right, our pleasure as well. We're going to hear CBS News next. Then we'll be back to meet the father of the design-build architectural movement, Dave Sellers. And a reminder that today at 1 o'clock, we've got equal time with Travin. What day is today? No, we actually have David Goodman, don't we? And then the getaway, Vermont Conversation at 1. Then the getaway with Greg Hooker from 2 to 4. Got to get my calendar straight. All right, this is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
I keep shaking my head at how many people of incredible brilliance you run into the longer you're here in Vermont. A couple of weeks ago, I got to spend a few hours visiting a wonderful little museum in Waitsfield that is right in my sweet spot. It's the Madsonian Museum that highlights wonderful industrial design. And running this incredible hidden little gem is architect Dave Sellers. Dave was one of the leaders of the design-build movement and creator of some of those famed structures up on Prickly Mountain in Warren. We're going to spend the next hour getting a glimpse of the Madsonian Museum and of the genius of Dave Sellers as he joins us now. Dave, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. I'm right here.
Yes, it's so great to have you on the phone line today. A week ago, this is like deja vu, a week ago, as we went to talk to Dave, our phones went down, and so it was a long hour of radio, but it's great to have you right here, Dave. Dave, what made you want to be an architect?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you ask that question because I had no idea that I even think about extradition when I grew up in Chicago and went to college in Connecticut. And I was interested in science. I studied, you know, chemistry and all that stuff. But I decided at one point when I was in college that chemistry was not for me. I coming back from the exam, down our icy steps in the middle of winter, I slipped and fell. All my papers blew all over the place. I went to the dean's office and said, I want to get out of chemistry. Not as interesting as I thought. And he said, you can do whatever you want. You already got a Bachelor of Science degree credit, so figure it out. I had no idea. This goes to all the parents out there whose kids don't know what they want to do.
Yeah.
My aunt and my mother's sister and her husband, Luke, with a great name, Mozart Lovelace, said, here's $1,000 to graduate. Go around the world on your own, by yourself. And that was a brilliant idea because it forces me out of my comfort zone with less money than is required to go around Europe. And through a number of accidents, I just said, wow. Because I had a motorcycle accident in France, and this gives a long answer, Rick, but it's real. And when I was recovering from this motorcycle accident in Avignon, and I spoke no French other than high school French in Illinois, imagine how good that was. So they sent me to a house that had there was a woman who was from Chicago, who, you know, at the end of the war, the GI, they sent a lot or offered French soldiers to travel the U.S. And this guy did, married this woman, brought her back to France. So she spoke perfect English. So I was recovering. She's feeding me. She says, where did he meet my son? He's studying architecture in Paris. So the guy shows up, my age. He's got a little motor scooter. They fixed my motorcycle. And we're driving around, you know, and he's sketching things. I said, what's it take a really good architect? So the guy says, you got to know your math and science. Well, I just had a degree in that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a good imagination. So I said to myself, well, you're looking at Mr. Imagination right there. You have to know how to draw. So he was drawing. I said, well, give me a piece of paper. And I started drawing. I realized if he could do it, I could do it. So that's what I said. I was going to go back and try to study architecture. So I was at Yale University. I know they never took attendance. So I didn't bother applying to the graduate school. I just showed up and started taking classes. And after about 3 or 4 months, I realized this is really what I want to do. So I looked at the dean's office and said, hey, look, I've been taking these classes, but I never actually applied or was admitted. And the dean just laughed, and said, okay, great, we'll try it. And that was it.
I love that. And I love your point, too, to parents. You know, I heard a parent say once, you know, you have till 30, you know, to figure out what you're going to do with your life. And I'll tell you, Dave, I have an undergraduate degree in management, and I think I've managed about as many people are in this booth with me right now in all the years. I have a master's in sports administration, and here I am in radio now for 25 years, so go figure. Now, you took that degree, that architectural degree, and you come to Vermont, you wind up there on Prickly Mountain, and you try something really different. You strike out in a different direction early in your career in architecture. You create this design-build movement. What the heck was going on there, Dave?
Well, this is it's really an interesting story, and I'm not sure what gave me the incentive to do it. My studies in graduate school were really interesting, and I decided to take a year off. My older brother said, I want to build myself a house. He was a MIT research guy in Poughkeepsie, New York. So I went to visit Thanksgiving. He says, look, I'm going to buy a house. Went to take a look at it. It was a Pine Manor Colonial, which is one of those fancy names for a ranch house.
Right.
So So we took a look at his pioneer colonial, and it was horrible. And he said, well, you know, we've got $20,000 we can spend on it. We own the land. So I said, at Thanksgiving, I said, well, look at it. If I, you know, because I was overconfident in my skills because I didn't really have any, but I thought I did. So I said to my brother and his wife, okay, if I can design a house you like better than that one for the same price, would you let me do it? And then his wife says, same price, better. Same price, better. Over and over. Yeah, that's it. So they said, okay, great. So I started designing houses. I designed like 10 houses. They liked all of them better, but the contractor, every one of them, the contractor said this is way too expensive. Mm. You know, I have a budget of $20,000. These are going to cost $60,000. And so I said, okay, I'm going to take the contractor's list of materials, everything, and restrict myself just to that list. And then on my vacation, I said, I'm going to get a job with the guy and learn how he builds it. So then I said, okay, I'm going to design something, use only his list and only his means of construction. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tweak it. So I did that and showed it to my brother and his wife. They said, okay, we like it better. So I took it back to the contractor. He said, no way. He said, because I have a million of these little things I could build blindfolded. I have to sit and think with this. So I went back to my brother. I said, okay, look, we got it. He said, what's he, the contractor? Can you build it? I said, he's not. I'm going to build it.
Oh, geez.
So I said, screw it. So I took a year off and I built the thing. And all of my student friends from their school came a weekend to help. And I realized that if you don't know how to make something, how can you tell someone else to make it? And the hammer that fell on that idea was I had a job one summer working on a giant parking garage in New Haven, Connecticut, designed by Paul Rudolph, who is this famous architect, the dean of the school at Yale, and I was the assistant engineer. My job was to hold the stick that had little numbers on it. He looked through the telescope, and it was really fun. It was a 5-story, 3-block-long, giant concrete parking garage. So one day, the engineer says, the architect's come into the site. The architect's coming. So we're up on the roof of the building. The architect comes. He's got a 3-piece suit on. He's looking like $1 million, a big roll of drawings. And everyone was sitting around a bunch of tables, which actually plywood on 2x4s.
Right.
My job was to get the coffee and donuts. So I was passing it around because I wanted to hear what the guy was saying. And the halfway through, the chief engineer and contractor for the concrete construction was standing behind the architect with his with his fingers on his head, his tongue sticking out, doing the rabbit, this, you know, this an idiot. So everyone leaves and says, what? You talk about that guy's a genius. He said, that guy doesn't know how to build anything. We could have saved half the price of this if he knew how to make it. So I said right then, I don't want to ever be in a place where some contractor says, you can't make this. So, because I had to know how to make something before I could tell someone else how to do it. And that's, wow. When we graduated, I got 3 or 4 of my friends to agree that we said, let's hunt around and just, we'll do it on our own. We had a couple $1,000. Let's build a little tiny thing our way, just so we can complete our education and do what we thought was the right thing to do.
I just got to ask you very quickly, Dave, did your brother and, more importantly, your sister-in-law approve of the final product?
They loved it.
Yes.
They totally loved it.
All
right. And it was a huge success.
I love it. Dave, one thing I'm going to keep using a term, and it's probably good that you explain to people, what is design build?
Here's what design build is, and it's in an interesting point of view that I subscribe to, which is that for the last 10,000 years, ever since, you know, the first person crawled in a cave and called it a house, mm-hmm. is that when you design it and build it, you're a master builder, you make it, you're doing it. That's historically, the architect has been on the construction site. Cathedrals are great examples of this. Mm-hmm. Even the Vermont State House, designed by Amy Young, was a design-build project. But if you're on site and you're making it, you make much better decisions of how to make it happen. And I think once the architect had kicked off the construction site around the turn of the last century, then everything became contractual. And so you have a set of drawings you give to somebody, and they give you a price. And then you have to stick by those drawings. The problem with that is, architecture is so complicated. There's 500,000 decisions that have to be made, you know, probably every month, mm-hmm. if you're building something. And you get the resources of the entire planet at your fingertips. And it's very, very hard to know in advance at a specific price what it can take to do something. And I think as a result, we've got a lot of boring, uninteresting buildings around. Mm-hmm. You know, the best ones, you know, sometimes the ones which were built years ago, that doesn't have to be the case. So I think our group, when we came to Vermont, said, well, let's just do it. Some people say you're winging it. We weren't winging it. We saw this as building three-dimensional sculpture when you're in the sculpture, making it. So we had to know how to cut materials. We probably became the world's experts on plywood. We can make anything out of plywood. And I think that's the whole design-build idea is based upon having the opportunity to create something using the materials available. And it's generally better and generally cheaper.
When you started building homes this way, which was what, back in the 60s, how did the architectural world react?
They hated it.
Well done, Dave.
They really did. They couldn't believe that, you know, you're supposed to work for 3 years as an apprentice, you know, and then you have to apply for your exam, and you have to pass all these tests. You know, it's interesting. I decided I wanted to become a registered architect, and we've been doing these things at Prickly. Really, you know, we came up here for 1 year. That was the idea. Mm-hmm. At the end of the year, we'd go. Well, for me, the year's not up. I'm still here.
They can't get you off the mountain.
It was so much fun. I mean, if you're enjoying what you're doing, it shows up in the chisel marks and in the extra little detail you're putting into whatever you're making. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. The craftsmanship in North America basically collapsed starting at the Depression and through World War II. All the craft houses basically stopped. You know, Tiffany and so on, that was one of the big names. They basically couldn't, there's no market, nobody had any money. So all the craftspeople kind of, and eventually they died. And so in the 60s, the crafts were emerging, and it was really horrible stuff. You'd go to a craft fair, we macrame plant hangers and yeah. little silly doodads of stained glass. But now, you know, 40 years later, the Vermont craftspeople are museum quality workers. I mean, they reemerge, and I think Vermont more than any other place. Mainly because everyone is self-employed. The reemergence of the skill of craft, whether it's ironwork or steel or metal or stone, glass, it doesn't make any difference. The people in Vermont are stunningly capable. And I think, you know, that shows actually, you know, the picture in Warren is an example. Mm. I think we brought in 30 different craftsmen from around the state to make parts of that place as a showpiece of what can be done.
You created quite a stir when you start to do the design build homes. You got a lot of national and international media attention. Tell us about that.
Well, that was all really kind of by accident. It really started with the New York Times. Because when we came out to Vermont, we started building these little buildings. We had no money, basically. And when we started, I had this idea. we came to the Mad River Valley. I better get to the source of that because I think that's an important thing.
Mm-hmm.
There were five of us that started to, right out of graduate school, said, we're going to do it our own way. And we think we can do it. We need to complete our education. So we started hunting around for a place where we could buy some cheap land and, you know, where somebody would buy something. And we started looking at shorefront property, you know, Connecticut. It was like all the real estate brokers said, you're 100 years too late. Impossible. And then I had this idea that if somebody was going to buy something, that a bunch of students fresh out of school were going to create, it wouldn't be their permanent home. It'd be kind of a getaway home. So then we had the logic track was, if somebody was going to do that, they're probably going to be in a city. And we see a city as a man-made mountain. You're in this kind of pile of buildings, you know, New York City being the most kind of best example of mm-hmm. that. It's like a man-made mountain. You're in the middle of this stuff. Well, if you want to get out, you're going to go to a natural valley, the opposite of the man-made mountain. So we start looking where natural valleys the size of Manhattan. There's two of them, one in Maine and one in Vermont. I'd never been to Vermont in my life. We started looking at the maps. And we went up to both. One's in Maine, owned entirely by the Brown Paper Company, a beautiful place, made towels. They extend the Mad River Valley, three ski areas, you know, Mohawk Airlines was they're zinging people back and forth from, you know, Burlington. It's okay, this is it. Huh. And we started looking around, where do we buy something? And even that sugar was way too expensive. So we stumbled upon a piece of property that we could buy from a farmer. It ended up being 400 acres at $1,000 down, and $1,000 a year for 10 years. And it's been a huge balloon payment. It's actually, when you look at it, it was not that big. And so I said, okay, wait, we got the land because we had $1,000. So I called up all my students, friends who were still in college, said, we'll give you $500 plus room and board to come to and help for the summer, $500 at the end of the summer. Basically, we rented a little house, and we had tents and some. I had a personal cook. Went to Muron's supermarket, said, could I get 90-day credit on food? And they loved it. Elma Muron said, sure, great, you got it.
Wow.
And we went to Gallagher's Lumber Company. We want 90-day credit on lumber, you know, because these guys somehow knew we had got this land, which was turned out had a mountain on it, which didn't have a name. So we went and started building stuff. And what happened was somebody in the New York Times found out about it, and they thought this was really cool. So they put a little article in the New York Times, you know, students building their own building. And then Walter Cronkite found out about this.
Oh.
And Walter Cronkite did it. Part of his 21st Century show that he did, I don't know how long it lasted, he sent a team up there, and we were out there with nail aprons and kind of, but it was so exciting because we didn't have any rules, and we just ordered up more materials with all the food and labor. So it was so exciting. We could do whatever the heck we wanted to. We had no budget. It was just us. And so as a result, we had so much fun. As a result, we were also working at night and facing around the clock 7 days a week, having the ball of our life. And then, on top of that, somebody from Life magazine called, and they wanted to look around. But this time we had a house we called the Bridge House. We had two bridges. They come to this rock outcrop. They were made out of plywood box beams that we were making. And we had Ed Orr was a a sculptor. And we wanted a sculptor to be involved with during the process, not later. When you're not going to add a piece of sculpture, you want the sculptural skill to be imbibed in making it. So that was kind of the types of thoughts we had. And so Life magazine came in. It took all of us out to dinner at Chalerie, which is just, it's really expensive. Nobody would dare go to Chalerie because it's just so expensive. And I remember he paid for dinner for everybody.
Wow.
As Life magazine guy, and 50 photographers. And we were just sort of blown away. Oh, my God. We all forgot about it, totally. Until I get a call from my dad in Chicago. And he was a little upset. And I said, Dad, what's up? My dad worked in the south side of Chicago in Donnelly's Printing Company. And they printed Life magazine. And he was called down to the print shop because there was an article coming out that had a huge fold-out picture of that very house, the bridge house, and it had my name on the bottom of it. And since I had no idea they were doing, all the magazines would never tell you when and what they're going to print.
Right.
So we had no idea. It was just a mystery. You know, they wanted to come out in the newsstand and, oh, look at this. So at the print shop, somebody says, is that your son? And my mom thought it was stupid for me to go and be an architect. She thought there's no money in it. She went through the Depression, didn't go to college. She said, you got to get a job. She wanted me to go into advertising because that's where the money is. And architects or artists, they don't ever make any money. So she hated the idea until Life magazine came out with this big fold-out. And all of a sudden, hey, this is terrific. I'm so proud.
Oh, my gosh. Dave, we're going to take a break again. We have a CBS News update coming, and then we'll be back with more from architect Dave Sellers, the father of the design-build movement. And listeners, a reminder, Red Sox host the Houston Astros again tonight. Coverage on WDEV begins at 6:10, first pitch at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
I remember hearing the same story. Peter Max wanted to become an artist. His mother said, "Ugh, you'll never make any money," and thought he made the wrong decision until finally he was on the cover of Time magazine, and then said, "Okay, I guess it was an okay decision." Dave, what does make great design?
You know, if I could answer that question really clearly, I think it would change the world.
Yeah. Do your best.
The thing about design is that a designer has the opportunity to take the resources of the planet, and you know, 4 or 5 million years ago, they weren't very many. Like it's cathedrals, you had to get rocks out of the local quarry. The Egyptians were able to get a quarry way, way away, but now, starting around 1850 or so, you had iron and glass and steel and aluminum and copper and wood, and all these materials were available. And eventually, systems like electricity and steam and heat became available. And somebody had to figure out how do you put all this stuff together, and you know, the assembly of these things is extremely complicated. And I think it takes an artist to do it because, in a way, art is the kind of skill. And sometimes it's intuitive and sometimes it's evolved. But it certainly has to do with an appreciation and respect of the materials you're dealing with. Now, if you look at nature, read all of the lyric poets about how beautiful nature is, and you inspect incredible flowers and insects and animals and so on. If you look at you're respecting the material, there's a famous American architect, Lou Kahn, who said, in a way, when they were building these, the headquarters for the nation's capital in India, he said, what does a brick want to be? And that's an interesting idea. What does a brick want to be? Well, if you ask yourself all those other materials, what do you want to be? What role do you want to play? It's like an orchestra, you know, and you've got the bassoon over here and the trumpets over there and the bass drum. They all have to make a symphony. And so the art of architecture and the art of the thing which you're looking at is a symphonic, you know, collage of all these. And like a good orchestra leader basically plays most of the instruments. An architect has to know how to make all the things that they're putting together to do it properly. And then it can become something really beautiful. And I think that that's, you know, this notion that it's in the eye of the beholder, sure it is. But at the same time, the architect has to know how you make it. The viewer can say, oh, I like that. The architect has to say, here's why you like it. Because all these things were honored and respected and played a role in it. So it becomes like a symphony. And I think that's what we are hopefully surrounding ourselves with as we go through the next millennia. Because if we don't, we're in trouble.
Now, the idea of great design is the basic concept behind the Madsonian Museum. You opened a decade ago in Waitsfield. For those who haven't been, what is the Madsonian and what kinds of beautifully or uniquely designed items will people see there?
Oh, great. Thank you for asking. The Madsonian is kind of a evolution of the spirit of design. You know, being a designer, I'm constantly looking and remarking and excited about some of the beautiful things that have been made over the millennia and even over the last year or two. And by seeing these beautiful things that people made, say, you know, where can you see these? And I realized there is no museum in the entire United States devoted only to design, only to those things which humans make. Humans are the only species on the planet that requires stuff. You know, that we have to create and make things. We're totally unable to live on this planet without having our stuff, you know. And so the first thing we have to have is a shirt. But if you look at it, you know, the shirt, you know, and shoes and hats and gloves and blankets and houses all become required elements. And so you say, well, what is our responsibility for these? And the notion is that we can't afford to take the resources of our only planet we've got, and then maybe not, certainly not in our lifetime, is another one where we can find more materials. It's all we've got. So, and we're likely to be lasting for tens of thousands of years more. At the rate at which we're degrading materials, we'll never make it past another 100 years. So part of the idea is to say, why don't we really celebrate the beautiful things that we make and make sure that's what we have as a responsibility as humans to deal with our resources. So the museum became a place where we could show these things and look at them. And, you know, as an architect, I've been, you know, collecting for years. I had my house and my office and my car, everything filled up with that, all those cool things. And then I said, you know, there is no museum. Let's start one. And I wanted to do it in Manhattan originally. Mm-hmm. I said, look, that's where the big, so I wanted to influence the world. I wanted to influence in the biggest city there is. It turns out that was a tough role. I wanted to put it in the Queen Mary.
Wow.
That was a long story. And I was sitting in the covered bridge in Waitsfield, and I couldn't figure out how to do it in New York. And there's a building right next door. I had a for sale sign. I walked into the people next to me who owned it, and they said, tell me about that house. And I said, you're not a skier. This isn't for skiers. I said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to put a museum of design. And the two women who run the kind of Christmas tree ornament shop there were fabulous ladies. They said, take the key, start. We opened 6 months later.
Wow.
You know, and right in the Mad River, I said, what do we call this thing? you know, I ask a lot of people, what would you call a museum of design on the Med River, but it has a large-scale vision. So I said, well, the museum in America with the biggest scale vision there is the Smithsonian in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I'm going to make a nod to the Smithsonian, because there's some guy named, you know, Smithson would say, well, I'm going to have the Med, like the Med River, the Madsonian is the name. And so I said, hey, that's good. So look at that. Nobody had Madsonian, so that's it. That's us.
Too
and
brilliant.
In it, we've got cars and motorcycles and toys and washing machines and irons, and even our upcoming UFO exhibit.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about next. You've got this UFO exhibit coming up, and you want kids to get involved with a design of UFOs. Tell us about that.
Well, I do. Here's what that, how that thing evolved. The UFO phenomena is now, the doors are open. You know, from it being a kooky, wacky, stupid idea, and the military said, well, there's something out there in the Air Force, and so they've agreed there's something that they don't understand that's flying around in our skies. So rather than just dropping it, I said, the imagination that people have of where we live and what the size of the planet and the size of the solar system and the universe needs to be forefront in our mind as we proceed through life. So I had this idea. Hey, let's have a contest to figure what those things look like. And there's a woman named Shannon Gilligan who she and her husband Ray Montgomery founded Choose Co. Adventures, your Choose Your Own Adventure book.
Mm-hmm.
She heard about it and said, bingo, I'll give you $100 so you can give away to all the best entries. So now we have this contest which has a cash awards. Just basic, it's really simple. On a single piece of paper with your name and age on the back, what do you think these things are? What do they look like? Where do they come from? And so to inspire people, I've got a series of film clips from the Star Wars films showing that in the museum. So people come in and see that, and those are magical. All those incredible ideas that came through those movies will inspire. So we've been getting people dropping off. Our front porch is open 24/7. We have a box there. So today I walked in, there was a drawing. We'd hardly announced this, half an hour earlier on Front Porch Forum. All of a sudden, there was a drawing that somebody put in, their idea of what these things look like. Now we have maybe 20 or 30 of them coming in. So then you may post it all through the museum as an idea to kind of say, where is our future? Where do we stand? Eventually, our planet will go up in smoke. When you look at the history of stars, as our star runs out of fuel, it's going to change into a white dwarf and Earth will be consumed by fire. So we're all going to be, there's no legacy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably true of every intelligent life on any planet, anywhere in the universe. They realize that so presumably, and Elon Musk is totally behind this. He said, we have to think about leaving our solar system. And it's going to take 1,000 years to sort of figure it out. So that's what he's up to.
Yep.
And I think getting people, especially the younger people, who aren't limited by, oh, that's stupid or that's crazy, I think because generally humans are supportive of kids' ideas, which is what it should be. So that's what we've got.
All right. I hope that the UFOs look like old Nash Ramblers, but I'm sure I'm wrong. The design-build architectural movement can be viewed up on Prickly Mountain in Warren, and the Madsonian Museum can be visited on Bridge Street in Waitsfield. In both cases, design at its finest, thanks to Dave Sellers. And, Dave, we only probably have about, 8 minutes left to get through some more talk about your architecture, so we'll do our best here. But first of all, let's talk about the work you've done with Patch Adams.
Okay, so that's a really interesting dig. I get a call from a guy named Patch Adams. I had no idea who he was. And he says, I'm a doctor, and I want to go to the community. Can I come up and take a look? Because the Prickly Mountain community had grown and was all really a lot of fun things to do, parades and floats and so on. Mm-hmm. So he shows up, and he's a tall guy in his clown outfit with mustaches and hats and funny-looking shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And he sits in the living room. We invite everybody over, and he strings a rope between one side of the room and the other and stands as like a slack rope and puts his foot on it and then balances on this rope, which is now dangling from one side of the building, the room in my living room, to the other, stretched tight under his foot, but he's about a foot off the ground. So this brought everyone focused, and there were like 30 people sitting around. As he'd walk up and down the rope, balancing perfectly, talking about health care and humor and laughter, and then he'd pull out some bulbs that are juggling. And it was totally, you know, mind-boggling that he was able to do this. And he sat down and said, look, laughter is the key element to health. And there's a lot of people who agree with that. He says, I want to build the whole hospital on that. And he asked me to come to West Virginia, which I did. And for 18 years, I helped Patch build, I think we built 7 or 8 buildings, including a master planning, all of them. Each of the building is he wants it to be wacky. Fetty mm-hmm. said one day, if this isn't the silliest thing you've ever done in your life, start over.
And that is the Gesundheit Institute in West Virginia. I want to get you to talk about another home you've created recently. This one up on Prickly Mountain, the Home Run House.
Okay, that. Thank you for asking about that, Rick. This is kind of a summary of 40 years of design build, and studying design and studying materials and realizing that when we start focusing on the issues of the world, and, you know, we as architects, we started buying appliances, and, you know, we started to wanted to buy some windmills in the 70s. Nobody had, so we started a windmill company. Don Mayer was the boss of it, and a small dog. So, and wood stoves with Vermont castings. And so we started really focusing on energy and use of materials and so on, and because we're so good with materials such as plywood. And we realized at one point that concrete is really an amazing material that is really underutilized. At anywhere in the world, you could make a phone call and have a bucket of you know, a huge bucket of liquid concrete show up that afternoon. And then you dump it into any form you want, and the next day it's a rock for the last 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, wow, that is pretty cool. But because we live in this giant hardwood forest, and because of wood being such an easy, accessible material for centuries, that's where we were stuck with that. But I said, wait a minute, let's try making something out of concrete. And we took all the formwork that we used in the picture in to build brick arches, and they were being thrown away. I said, oh, I'll take those. I taught a class at Yes Tomorrow called The Joy of Concrete. And we pulled all these wooden arches together and poured concrete on them. And we pulled the forms off, and it was amazing. It was this like wonderful collage of arches. We finally made a whole house out of it. And because all these arches, it looked like one of the bunkers of the beaches of Normandy. Hmm. It was like the nickname became the Arches of Bunker, then the Bunker of Arches, then the Archie, but now the place is called the Archie Bunker. And based on that, it was such a success that I was able to get 2 philanthropists in San Francisco to put up $2 million. Can you imagine? That's a little nonprofit to our museum. They said, we want to build a demonstration house of the best of technology, the best use of materials available anywhere on the planet, and let's do it. And we had meetings in San Francisco and L.A. all over the place. I finally convinced myself that we got to do it in Warren, Vermont, because I've got to be within half an hour, 5 minutes really, of where we're going to make it, because we're not sure what we're going to make. And so we produce this with that geothermal heating from the ground. We're heating the ground in the summer with the hot water heating system, so that the ground temperature under the building will be around 70 degrees starting in winter. So all we have to do is take that 70 degrees and make it into 80. And with heating, we have systems where you can change, because the building will last for 1,000 years. Everything will evolve. It could be a one-room house, could be a three-room house, could be a dormitory, could be a shelter for homeless. So it has to be able to handle a lot of these things. So all the mechanicals are under these aluminum plates, which we pull up and change the technology over time. And there's walls that move and hinge and slide away. So we're able to try these things, and it's proven to us, we can make a building that is appropriate, that lasts for a long time, that doesn't use up the resources and becomes, and it has to be beautiful. Not that I'm able to make things beautiful all the time, as much as I wish I was.
Mm-hmm.
You have to try. You have to try to make it as beautiful as you possibly can, because if it's not, you can have the best solar system, the best everything. If it's butt ugly, whammo, 20 years later, they tear it down.
That's right.
You know, it's got to be there. If you want to make something beautiful, it has to be permanent. And making permanent, that's what our museum has talked about, is permanence. Mm-hmm. And the key driving element of permanence is if it's beautiful. And, you know, the example of that is the Pantheon in Rome, built 2,000 years ago, still there. No one will ever tear it down.
No.
Because they made it so, I don't know if you've seen that, Rick, but you should if you haven't. It's an astonishing piece of civic art. And, you know, we have some in Vermont. You know, our agriculture building is a great example. Our state house is a great example.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the post office, Montpelier, was torn down. You know, Penn Station was torn down. Mm-hmm. How we, as a civilization, tear down these beautiful things, I can't understand it. But it's much easier to tear it down than it is to make it. And there's not a lot of people who are given the opportunity to make something as beautiful as they possibly can.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of, you know, that's why I teach, that's why I open up the museum. Because I really think that as a culture, we need to start respecting the materials and respecting our culture, so we honor that in the most beautiful way we can. And to me, that's the safety zone that we've got, I think, in our democracy, that we can make things gorgeous.
Dave Sellers was named one of the 100 foremost architects in the world by Architectural Digest. He's the founder of Architecture's Design Build Movement. And a decade ago, he created the Madsonian Museum of Industrial Design in Waitsfield. And you can learn more about that at madsonian.org. Dave, it's an absolute pleasure chatting with you. We could go on for hours. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Yep, I enjoyed this so much. That's our show for today, Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Don't forget, you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio up next with Bill Sayre. I'm Rick Zingari. I will meet you back here tomorrow.